Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers of the workshop and the conference for the invitation to speak. It's always great being at the KITP at these events. I'm going to discuss basically some new technology to compute results in relatives of the SYK model. And this technology bypasses the Schwinger-Dyson equation. It's more algebraic. And I'll be discussing two papers, one with Prithvi Narayan and Joan Simon, who's in the audience, where we've set up the computation and computed the two-point function, and a later paper with Mishai Zaschenko, Vladimir Ovlansky, and Janice Torrance, where we computed the four-point function. Let me just advertise Vladi, who's a student of Ofer, who's in the market now and is an excellent physicist, young physicist. Okay, so I'm going to define what's the double scale, the SYK, and what are the core diagrams. Then basically how we analytically evaluate. So basically this would be translating the SYK computation into some set of combinatorial rules. And then the second item would be how to analytically evaluate this combinatorial problem. And I'll try and be brief on the combinatorics. I mean, I'll be discussing mainly the first paper, which is a little bit light on combinatorics, and the second paper is much more intensive, but I just couldn't fit the second one into 14 minutes and do all the details. And I don't think they're that critical for the conceptual issues. So what I'd like to try and say in the second item that behind this combinatorics, there's basically just some black box that you put in the model in one side or a large class of models, and out come basically automatically the boundary dynamics in terms of Schwarzschild or the generalization of the Schwarzschild to all scale. And you can wonder whether this is just a cheap way, well, the fastest way of obtaining some kind of bulks from combinatorics. And then I'll discuss the two-point function and briefly the four-point function. We see the appearance of quantum groups, and then some conclusions. Okay, so this is a transparency which you've seen a zillion times. This is the SYK model. These are the conventions I'm going to use. I'm going to label the number of fermions in their interaction by P, and be reserving Q for something else. J are random Gaussian couplings, although in the large N limit you can kind of slightly loosen the restriction on Gaussianity. And this model is almost conformal, has maximal chaos, and it's dual to ADS2 and JT gravity. So usually what one does is fix this parameter P, the size of the interaction, and take N to infinity. And then you get a nice set of Schwinger-Dyson equations which you can solve. Now, there's a further elaboration, which is that you can then take P to infinity and the theory simplifies further. Now, I'll be interested in a different limit, which was called, which is dubbed the double scale limit. Basically, we learned on this from the Kotler et al. Paper, and that relates to earlier work by Erdos and Schroeder, and there's some related work by Garcia, Jain, Verbacher. So this double scale limit, we take n to infinity, but we keep p squared over n fixed. So it's kind of a relative of the p going to infinity in the previous item, but it's actually different. But morally speaking, there should be some relation between the two models. And what we're going to do, we're going to obtain exact results in lambda. That's going to be technically, and I'll explain what lambda and n might mean in this case. Now, if the reason that this is still interesting in the context of ADS-CFT, that if we take lambda to zero then, and which kind of tries to bring us back to the SYK fixed P regime, but not quite, and we also scale the energy to zero, we recover the Schwarzian theory. This is called triple scaling. So basically anything that we can do in the ordinary ADS2, we can do in this model, except that we can solve it a little bit better than the ordinary SYK. So before we jump into the combinatorics, what's the interpretations of this lambda and n to the minus one? This is very tentative. I mean, of course, one would need to do more computations to substantiate this. So you can think about lambda and n to the minus one as kind of the analogs of the alpha prime and the G string expansion. So when I take a G string to zero, I'm still in string theory. I have some nonlinear theory which I can discuss, and that's going to be the case for us. G string controls the number of kind of underlying quantum degrees of freedom, black hole entropy, etc. When I take G string to zero, I kind of wash over all of these degrees of freedom. Here it's described by n, that's the size of the Hilbert space, and when I take n to infinity, I can ask what do I have left which is still interacting, and that's governed by alpha, so by lambda, so lambda is kind of analogous to alpha prime. Now, the parameter that I will use a lot is q, which is e to the minus 2 lambda. So as I've said before, in the limit lambda going to zero, which is q goes to one, we have ADS2 with JT gravity. And in the limit of q going to zero, you'll basically see that you get the kind of Gaussian RMT model on the nose. So this basically extrapolates smoothly from ordinary Gaussian random matrix theory to a model that has, in particular, the SYK behavior. And you can, for example, ask, you know, what's the gravity dual of this Gaussian RMT? That probably would be some strong coupling background if it makes any sense to discuss it in gravity. Please feel free to ask me questions during the talk. It's probably more productive than keeping it to the end. Okay. So so let's start by evaluating the partition function in this model, and that will basically set up a lot of the machinery of core diagrams, how we deal with them analytically, and what's this auxiliary Hilbert space, which will then reduce to the Hilbert space of the Schwarzian. So what we're going to do, basically kind of start doing the very traditional thing of evaluating the partition function by expanding it. So the tracer is normalized to one, and brackets with subscript j means that I'm doing the ensemble average. So what I want to describe is basically just these moments. You know, find some convenient technique for evaluating these moments. So I'll need to introduce a little bit more notation. So there would be a couple of technical slides, and then there would be some quick discussion of maybe conceptually what we are doing. So an interaction is a specific interaction inside the Hamiltonian is determined by a set of p indices, and I'm going to give this vector of length p. Then I'll denote it by capital I. So the interaction just looks like this. And I goes over all the different vectors with random coefficients. Okay, so psi I is going to be this polynomial of the psi. So now when I compute this kind of an object, trace h to the k, I have k of these psi's sitting inside the trace in the Hilbert space. And then I need to compute in statistics this expectation value of the j's. Okay, so far this is pretty simple. Now, let's just assume that these J's are Gaussian. Again, in large N, I can relax this condition. So there's just I just do Wick's theorem, and there's a pairwise contraction of these guys. And there are some factors floating around, which I'm not going to discuss. They're all in the paper. Yes?
You're doing anneal everything here.
Yes. I mean, the model is supposed to be self-averaging, and let's hope that we can extract information from this also just as reliably. So this automatically gives us the structure of a core diagram. So what's a core diagram? It's basically a circle where I have a bunch of dots, and I connect pairs of these dots. Basically each of these guys is an insertion of one of these terms ji psi I for a specific I. So each code has associated with it a specific I. Okay. Let's go back to the previous description. So this term basically pairs the I. So I have here a string of psi i's, each of them being this composite operator, and there are pairs of i's identified. Now the trace has some orientation, so I just arrange these psi i's on the circle, and I tell you which one is the same. So each of these links, each of these codes has an index I. So what we need to evaluate is a sum over code diagrams, and then just trace of this product of psi i's, where I sum over the index I for each of these codes. And then the complexity comes about because I need to start moving these psi's through each other. Some of the original constituent fermions appears in several of these codes, and I need somehow to find out some machinery that deals with this. So the basic operation is that of just exchanging. So of course, so psi capital I5 is the same as psi capital I7. So if I commute this through this guy, I'm going to have two of these psi i's adjacent to each other, and that will square to one. So if I bring these codes adjacent to each other, I just have a bunch of ones, and I can evaluate, it's going to be simple to do the trace. So the question is, what happens when I commute? So say I want to commute 5 and 6. I want to go from this configuration into this configuration. So what happens is when I do this, when I change the ordering, the only difference is that I pick up some phase here, -1 to the number of intersections. Now, if P is much, much smaller than 1, this size of intersection has a Poisson distribution with average p squared over n. So that's the thing that I want to keep fixed. And you can also show that in this scaling, there are no triple intersections. So each pair of codes has a common set of indices from the original indices of the fermions. That object is Poisson distributed, and there are no triple intersections. So the whole problem just reduces to the interaction of codes. Now, so what's the penalty that I pay for an intersection? I just need to sum over this factor with the appropriate probability that the intersection is of some given size. I just need to compute some expectation value in the Poisson distribution. And what I get is that each intersection gives me a power of q. So yeah, there's some mismatch here, so it gives me a power of q. So trace h to the k averaged over j is just a sum over these core diagrams, q to the number of intersections. And this is some enumerative combinatorics problem that I can try and solve. For example, if I want to compute trace h to the fourth, this is going to be just 2 plus q because there are two diagrams with no intersections and one diagram with an intersection. So we basically need to find some machinery that conveniently spans all these configurations for an arbitrary k, spans all the configuration and effectively resums this code diagram. Okay, so far I basically summarized the other people's work. So what I'm going to discuss next is to find some efficient way of doing this computation. So what we are going to do, we are going to cut this core diagram somewhere, turn it into some kind of linear process that is described by a transfer matrix. I'm going to cut this and say go anti-clockwise. So node 1 is connected to this one. This is the number 5. Then 2 is connected to number 4. 3 is connected to number 6. And in principle, if I had a more complicated diagram, this could have continued further and further with a different set of connections. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to define some kind of a hopping process where stage zero is I start here, there are no chords. Stage one, I turn on the chord. Stage two, I turn on the chord. Stage three, and then, of course, what I can do is at various stages, I can start closing chords. So there's some process which I'll turn into a transfer matrix, which does one of the two things. I can either open a chord, in which case I will put it at the bottom of the stack because I don't want to commit myself to what it will intersect from the previous guys. Or I can have a chord closing. And then, suppose, so here I have four chords. Each of these chords can close. If the upper one most closes, when it goes down, it intersects three chords. Here there's an example of this one. When it goes down and closes on a node, it intersects two chords. So that gives me a factor of Q squared. So basically, as I go with this transfer matrix, I can either open, or when I close, I have to ask, you know, what additional factor this adds to the transfer matrix. And basically, when it closes, that's it. I don't need to do anything with it anymore. It's not going to intersect anything else. So basically, as I go from one step to the other, the only thing that I need to remember is how many chords do I have open. So I'm going to define an auxiliary Hilbert space, which is just the number of chords. So there's an element, in the basis, which is just the number of chords. And then there's going to be weights on this number of chords. And the weights are just going to be sum over all the chord diagrams up to this stage. Okay, the coefficient of the lth vector, suppose I'm at step I and I'm interested in the coefficient of L. Of the so basically this is going to be something that tells me, you know, I did I steps and I have L open chords. I want to associate a weight to that. The weight is going to be just the sum of all the chord diagram in the past, including all their weights. So these chord diagrams in the past basically bubbled. They kind of opened and closed. There were all kinds of intersections, and I sum over all of these steps. All of the weights associated with all of these chord diagrams, just assuming that at step I have L chords open. So for example, here V2, I open a chord and I can close it, or I can open two chords. This is two steps, so this is index 2. It's going to be 1, 0, 1, because there's no intersection. In the next step, for example, if I close this guy, there's going to be a contribution of order Q to this entry here. So this is just something that basically gradually builds all of these chord diagrams and with the appropriate weight. Now I can write a recursion relation for this process, and it's just this relation. So this tells me that I open a chord with weight 1. This tells me that I close one of the chords with an appropriate weight, which is which one I close. So there's a simple recursion relation, and I'm going to call this matrix T. This is going to be my transfer matrix. Any questions?
All are cossics as independent?
Yeah, I mean,
that means this is not exact, so you already make an approximation.
No, this is exact in the double scaling limit of P squared over N fixed, because then indices appear only in two chords, and it's only an issue of intersection of pairs of chords. If you want to compute corrections to that, you would, it's an issue of how to do corrections to this systematically within a transfer matrix. Not clear that you can still do it within a transfer matrix. Okay, I can conjugate this T to a symmetric form, and then this T, and I'll call this symmetric form T hat, I basically conjugate it by something on the diagonal, so this is a very simple operation. And what I get is that my transfer matrix is AQ plus AQ dagger, where these are the Q deform oscillator algebra. And this is some algebra that has been studied in the context of quantum groups. And we'll see that basically another quantum group shows up later. This is what's called the Arikun Q deform oscillator algebra, and this process actually is discussed a little bit in the math literature. It's what's called the Q Brownian motion. Q Okay, so so basically at state 0 and k, suppose I compute h to the k, there are no chords. So trace h to the k looks like an expectation value of t to the k between two states 0, which is just one sitting on no chords, basically. Now, any insertion that I have in a correlation function of e to the I t h turns into an e to the I t capital T, or the t that I had before. So I can think about this t hat as the Hamiltonian in an auxiliary Hilbert space, basically. So, and the spectrum of this t hat is the same as the spectrum of the original, of the original system. I basically just see, you know, which energies show up in exponentially. So what I did is there's this black box, you kind of crank it, out comes a Hilbert space and a new Hamiltonian. And what I'd like to argue is that this thing plays the role of the Schwarzschild, and you can see that it's related to the Schwarzschild in it. Well, we kind of argue, not very precisely, that it's related to the Schwarzschild in its Liouville form. Okay, so to complete this, we need to diagonalize T, and you can do it. Basically, it's given. If this thing wasn't here, you would see that it's given by Q Hermite polynomials already mentioned yesterday. This is the first time I'm using this specific. There's no free lunch. Okay, I don't know what happened, but anyhow, these are the Q Hermite polynomials. You can define them in various ways. This recursion relation is one of the definitions. This Q is the parameter of the deformation, and X is related to the energy. So you can do some sanity checks, and that's what I said before. When Q goes to 1 and you do this triple scaling, you can show that it goes over to the Schwarzschild. Okay, maybe I can explain this a little bit. So you see, basically, let's see what happens when you go to... How should I think about this operator? So there's this guy and there's this guy above and below the main diagonal. So I can think about this as a scattering process where on a half a line, where the edge of this half line, the infinity, kind of is very large values of L. And I scatter something from there, and it bounces off some discretized wall and goes out to infinity again. So if I want to go to low energies, really what I need to look is basically identify the low energy state in the spectrum at infinity. The rest would be a scattering issue.
Are there ones missing below that?
This is just A, and my full Hamiltonian is A plus A dagger. So this is the symmetric form. Yeah. Right, so now when I go down, what I see is that I just have 1 over 1 minus Q above and below the diagonal. So that just looks like a second order differential operator when I turn this into some continuous approximation. So, and that gives me something like a d squared phi approximation to this matrix when I go down to low energies. Now the correction to that is going to be q to the n. So I have a d squared, and then there's q to the n, which I'm going to write as e to the phi log q as a potential term. So what you get here is that the approximation of this matrix way down in the low energy is just given by basically the Liouville form. Now that's kind of the hand waving level, but you can probably do this a little bit more precisely.
What does the spectrum look like?
Right. Okay. So it's actually skipped.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So again, if you want to analyze these matrices, again, if you think about it as a scattering problem, it's just You know, when you have a scattering, the spectrum is just determined by infinity, and that's it. So you just have a toplets matrix, and you can compute its the eigenvalues exactly. This is the these are the eigenvalues that you get. They agree with the Erdos and your computation, of course. And then if I want to compute the partition function, now in the exponentiated form, I just need to do integral over theta, the range here, that's how I parameterize. A rho of theta, which is some inherent, which is some original density associated with the eigenvalues of this matrix. But if I were to compute trace in that space, I would just have this rho. But here I compute a matrix element, so I start at zero and end with zero. So I have this this form factor, and then e to the minus beta e of theta. Now this thing turns out to be a constant, this parameterization, and the only issue sits in this form factor, and you can evaluate and get the measure that was already known. Now this is very similar in Louville to the statement that when you do an integral, when you evaluate the Schwarzschild in Louville, you need to impose some funny boundary conditions that you start under the strong coupling wall. That's for us the same as starting with the state zero, or in what we heard a couple of days ago, you need to put this matrix P when you compute the e to the minus beta h. If you want to compute the partition function, it would be e to the minus beta h times p. So that's the same as, that probably is the same as that. Now, this guy is a Pochhammer symbol, which is defined here. It's basically, I mean, this thing is basically a theta function. Okay. Okay, so point one, I kind of tried to explain. The second point, when Q goes to zero, you go over to random matrix theory, because then you basically kill intersections, right? So the only thing that you have are the large n planar contractions of random matrix theory. You go from one to the other. Now I'd like to speculate a little bit on the relation to complexity of the operator. You see, basically what we do, suppose I give you an operator and I want to see how it propagates in time. Then I compute e to the iht on the right and e to the minus iht on the left. And basically these h's, you know, expand it into a Taylor expansion, and so these h's start bubbling basically. Now, if I just include chords that don't close, then basically what I have, each insertion of H adds another block to the operator of size P. So the operator becomes larger and larger. So these n's, you could roughly think about them as the size of the operator in some in the space. Now, if I have chords connecting, say, things within a given exponent or going between the two exponents, it means that I've inserted the some specific term in the Hamiltonian twice, and that cancels each other up to little pieces that are chopped off by overlaps, with partial overlaps with other operators, with other insertions. So statistically, this n tells you what's the length of the operator. Now, if we want to go to... So basically, every n is a kind of a blob on itself in operator space, because every time I add a very big chunk of size p. Now, if I want to go to the low energy, I multiply it by e to the minus beta h, when beta has to be large. So basically, these blobs are very, very large, and they start intersecting with each other. There's going to be some overlaps between them. And that's the regime we're kind of interested in. And then, of course, you don't want to work in the basis where n is fixed. Rather, you want to go to this energy space that coherently sums over these sizes of operators. So the message so far is that these core diagrams are an efficient way of keeping a minimal set of correlations while coarse graining over all other microscopic data. So I basically just explicitly do the average. I just keep very minimal information of, you know, this guy talks to that guy, the fifth term compute talks with the seventh term in the expansion, etc. And that's basically the minimal set of correlations that I need in order to propagate things in time. They are an effective description obtained after averaging over J. At least I don't know how to get more microscopic data out of these core diagrams. Now, the reason that I'm kind of highlighting this is that T reduces to the Schwarzschild, it captures the full energy spectrum. So you can wonder whether this T is really encodes the full SYK-ADS2 duality. And then you can ask whether this applies to gravity. So I basically gave you some effective field theory description that does, that computes every coarse grain. Well, okay, I'm overselling. Maybe there is a description which, an effective field theory which computes every coarse grain object that you're interested in. And that's basically all we know that gravity does, unless you're a fuzzball fan. Okay. So how do we compute observables and, you know, correlation functions in this model? So there's another piece of philosophy which I need to sell you, I'm afraid. Which is, what are the correct observables? You know, what are the universal observables? So as universal observables, I'm going to take random operators, which are basically very similar, except that they have a different set of coefficients. So this should be P prime. So I give you a new operator. So there's a new length, P prime or PA. And I can define a new operator M by summing over polynomials of the fields with this length P prime or PA with some random coefficients, which again I'm going to take random independent zero mean, etc., similar normalization. Now, why is this the right ansatz? So, I mean, the reason we started thinking about this is that. You see, when I have a quantum chaos problem, there's the issue of the Hamiltonian, but there's also the issue of the statistics of the observables, which is basically just as important. Now, if I want to have something that looks like gravity, I need that, say, four-point functions will factorize. Okay, so I want to have some diagram, some, you know, I mean, pictorially, there's going to be two contractions here. What am I missing? And then I'm missing the most tricky one, which is this guy. All right, so all of these should contribute more or less the same. Now, if I want to think about, suppose I think about this in some very small energy band in the microcanonical ensemble. So time evolution doesn't play any role. So what I want is to have a set of matrices M drawn from some statistical ensemble in which these three diagrams contribute more or less the same. I mean, if this operator was a UN, and I'm working in this small band, so let's call the number of state e to the s zero. If this was invariant under U e to the s zero and had ordinary random matrix theory statistics, anything given by e to the minus n times some potential, then this diagram would be killed. So what I want to start with as statistics of observable is something that has approximate factorization. And these diagrams, when lambda is small, you can show have this factorization property. That's the same statement that the Hamiltonian has a similar factorization property. So just thinking about, you know, in the microcanonical ensemble with no time evolution, what's the statistical class of the observable leads you to move away from the ordinary ensembles and into more exotic ones like this one. So this is a kind of how we started.
Sorry, does that mean we won't consider the kind of operators that are constructed from the Schrödinger-Weiss equation?
Okay, so it's yes and no. Okay, what's going to happen is that this operator is going to reduce in the low energy conformal regime to an operator of dimension P prime over P. So if you just look at a fermion, at a single fermion, this is going to be an operator of very, very low dimension, and you might worry whether that does the trick, whether that's a useful operator. Now, however, if so this is the problem with the usual operators. Although Douglas tells me that he computed some of this stuff using the sigma G prescription, and it reproduces core diagrams, and that uses the fermion bilinear, right? So it's kind of not clear. Now, but you can ask something else. Suppose I give you a specific set of psis, and I ask you to compute its two-point function. Then that gives you the same result as this computation. So at the level of a two-point function, you can put here a single monomial, just because that just reduces to a sum over a single monomial at the level of the two-point function. So if you choose a specific monomial, you'll get the same two-point function, but higher point functions will be very different. But I mean, you can compute. It would just be an issue of computing the overlaps of these core diagrams where you sum over the indices capital I with a specific set of indices. But you can do the computation, but these seem to be more, well, okay. Let me go to point two and three and say why we think this is a little bit more natural. But you can do the computation for single psi. Okay, now another argument is that if we're doing ADS2, if we want to think about generally ADS2, then we're really embedded in some higher dimensional space. And the set of which are the observables that you have really has to do with the boundary of that bigger space. That's where you define your field theory. So you really have to worry when you go to this, when you do this RG, what are the operators that you inherit from some, maybe higher dimensional theory. Now, so you're really interested in some universal data that doesn't have to do with how exactly you define the theory. So this gives you a more universal, robust set of things to compute. Now, finally, so the way we really think about this, these psi just span the degrees of freedom of the black hole. They're not related to single trace operators. You don't necessarily want to probe the system with specific psi. It's a little bit of a deviation from the ADS CFT duality, but it's more in the spirit of how, say, Subir uses ADS2. You know, I give you the background, and then, you know, just give me a mass of a fermion on it, and that's it. You can put whatever you want. You're not really restricted to saying, you know, this model comes with a specific fermion. And this parameter P prime plays the role of the mass of the of this composite operator in this space. So we really think about psi as spanning the degrees of freedom, not necessarily, well, probably not single trace, not related to single trace operators in any way. And the Hamiltonian acts as the random operator of some sort, of some statistics on this Fock space of psi. But if I look in ADS-CFT, I mean, there's no really big difference between the local Hamiltonian operator and any of the other single trace operators. So trace X squared versus trace H to the L, say in N equals 4. Of course, the integrated H plays a very significant role, but the local H, it's not clear that it's distinguished from any other operator, at least in terms of the statistics in which it acts on the states of the black hole. So if the local H operator acts as a random matrix of some statistical type, why not have all the other single trace operators be of a similar statistical type? So these are the motivations for focusing on this class of operators. But this is a okay. Leaving the philosophical part while I'm still alive, and going back to the computation, how do we compute a two-point function? So I want to compute trace h to the k1, and then m, h to the k2, and then m. And pretty much by the same argument as before, I do averages over the coefficients in J. That gives me a chords connecting H insertion. And I also do the averages over the insertions in M, and that gives me another chord that connects the two M insertions. Okay, so I'm pretty much back to a very similar problem, except that now I have two types of chords in my diagram. One set of chords is fixed, and the other set of chords is kind of bubbling, basically, and I need to sum over all the chord diagrams. Now, pretty much by the same reasoning as before, all of these operators are made out of the same constituent. So just as I move insertions of pieces of H across each other, I can move insertions of pieces of J. So this is kind of crossing that we saw before. Now I have this additional crossing. Now, again, these are, as far as I'm concerned, just two sets of indices. They are sets of different size. Still, the intersection is Poisson distributed, and I can compute what's the penalty for crossing one through the other. So if here the penalty was e to the minus p squared n over n, here it's e to the minus p pa over n. And I get this fixed in my scaling also. So p scales like square root of n, and p a scales like square root of n. So now what I have is, if I want to compute a matrix element, a trace of this type, it's the sum over chord diagram where I give different weights to different kinds of intersections. So here, and of course there are also intersections, you know, suppose I have several operators with different weights, you know, say four-point functions of two sets of two distinct operators, then there are going to be intersection of M chords of different types, etc. So I just need to compute this object. So this is pictorially, you have this dashed M contraction, and H chords can bubble in and out and do whatever they want to do, and they need to evolve this thing through. So for the two-point function, there's a cheap way of doing it. For the four-point function, you actually need to do this combinatorics much more carefully, where you include an arbitrary number of chords coming in, an arbitrary number of chords coming out, and some bubbling happening here. And this is a complicated but doable combinatorial problem. But if I want to compute the two-point function, there's a cheap way of doing it, which is I can basically cut my chord diagram wherever I want. So I'm going to cut it before the first M insertion. So there are no lines coming in. So the only thing that I see is that I start bubbling these, turn these things, lines closing into lines going out, because I don't have any of these guys. So I just bubble these H insertions. And then at some point, I just need to ask how many H lines do I have, and give it the weight Q tilde, which is Q tilde to the power of this number of lines that I have. So this matrix element reduced to start with zero. I'm sorry, there shouldn't be an M1 here. So start with zero, then bubble it K1 times, then just give the appropriate weight according to the number of intersection, then propagate it another K2 times and close it so that there are no loose ends, literally. So we kind of know everything, right? We know the form factor of zero in the energy states. This is a diagonal matrix, so we can compute what S looks in the energy eigenbasis exactly. And this is the general form of the two-point function that you get, basically. So we kind of get something which is an effective vertex, an insertion vertex in this chord diagram Hilbert space. So actually what's going to happen in the more general case, you're going to get insertions of bilocal operators, very similar to what you get in the Louville description of the Schwarzschild, but generalized to the entire model. Okay, if I want to discuss the four-point function, that's a little bit more complicated, but well, more complicated. But at the end of the day, you can model it similar to these works that basically provide you with a set of Feynman rules for the Schwarzian theory. And what we're going to have are basically Q-deformed version of those Feynman rules, which capture the entire theory. So a segment is just e to the minus delta tau e of theta. E of theta is this cosine theta over 1 minus, Then there's this measure. The insertion is just a square root of this two-point function form factor that we saw before. And finally, what you really need is this intersection vertex. So if I want to compute a crossed four-point function, I need to propagate four states, and there's this R matrix that tells me what happens at the intersection. So these are not diagrams in ADS2. These are code diagrams where I've summed over all the H's. But they capture the same topology. So what I need to compute is this R. Now what it turns out, for reasons that we do not understand, for the Schwarzian, the R matrix is the sixth trace symbol of SU11. That we can kind of understand. But in the double scale, SYK4, the entire theory on the entire energy range from minus minimal value to plus maximal value, the R matrix seems to be related to the 6J symbol of a quantum deformation of SU11 up to some factors. I mean, it matches up to some factor which we believe are normalization factors, but we did not establish that. And again, this is the R matrix for the entire model. And there's also some relation between this quantum group and the quantum group that I showed you before. That the first one is a contraction of this one. So it seems to be pointing that somehow you basically just need to go to some Q deformations in order to solve this entire model. And this is the R matrix, if you're interested. So let me summarize. They are kind of quite a tractable object. They capture this minimal set of correlation that you need in order to describe basically the correlators of this operators, and you automatically coarse grain over everything else. The auxiliary Hilbert space seems to be related directly to the boundary gravity dynamics. And generally, I think the philosophy is that if you have a dynamical problem and you're able to reduce it into some kind of algebraic problem, that's always useful. We can use it to do exact computations. And then there's the question whether this SL2Q is really this rigid algebraic structure with which you can solve the entire model. Now the question, which is hidden, is basically, I mean, you can take this in various directions, but I think what is most interesting to me is whether this is really a sleight of hand way of reconstructing the bulk. Just explicitly keep the information that you want, encode it as just a set of what's correlated with what, do all the H the codes that basically dress up these pieces of information, and is this just this two-dimensional gravity or gravity more generally? Okay, let me end here.
Questions, comments?
So if you start from the G and sigma action, and you take the large Q limit, you get something that looks like a Liouville type action.
Right.
And
right.
Whose prefactor is N over Q squared.
Right.
And so if you take this limit naively, you get quantum Liouville theory.
I thought that would not give you this structure, but Douglas tells me that he worked out the rules that come from this. You need to expand and resum. And then you have a bunch of integrals. And each term in that reproduces the core diagram rules. So it's there, but you need to resum. And the question is whether in that, to go to this energy eigenbasis. And the question is whether there, in this G sigma approach, you can do, there's a useful way of switching bases. I mean, the trick here is that you turn the combinatorial problem into an analytic problem that then you just compute eigenvalues and exponentiate them. I mean, that's should be doable also in the other description, but again, I just learned a week and a half ago that you can actually work very well with that description. So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's a relationship between quantum deformation of SL2 and Virasoro representation theory. So one way of saying the results of Mertens and friends is that there's in this particular limit of the Levy theory, they're taking a limit where this quantum deformation goes away, and it's so their correlation functions are the Schwarzian limits of Virasoro conformal blocks. Do you know if this SL2 deformation is the same one? Because I know there are several in the mathematics literature.
As far as I know, it's not. It's not that one. I mean, usually that deformation, usually one discusses deformation where Q sits on the unique circle. Here, Q is between 0 and 1. So it's not the same. It's not the same deformation. But I have to say I'm not fully versed in the quantum group literature. So probably people who know more about it in the audience.
Since the free energy is extensive, the double scaling limit is just a large Q limit, as one also mentioned. So I wondered, can you go beyond the double scaling limit to get corrections to the free energy, 1/Q corrections?
I think we have results that are exact in Q. So, you know, expansions in anything to do with Q is okay. But what seems to happen, I mean, you can write the general expressions for a general core diagram as something, choose something, as you wrote. And you can ask what are the corrections to that. And it seems like it's arranging itself in corrections that go like 1/P, where P is the size of the interaction. Now, you can probably compute like leading correction or, I mean, that you can extract, say, for the partition function, but we didn't find yet any systematics of this. I mean, like in a fantasy world, this 1/P would be related to some genus expansion of some string moving in this background or something like that. But we were, so you'll need to, I mean, part of the fantasy is that you look at these disks and somehow you dress up these core diagrams such that you're only left with the external particles, and they just, and this dressed up version is just particles moving on ADS2. So a part of this fantasy would be that higher loops have to do with some writing the codes diagram on some non-trivial spaces. But it's like, you know, late night fantasy.
Okay, thank you.
So to what degree have you worked out your techniques for multi-trace expectation values?
We didn't work out. That should be doable but tricky. I mean, we have some ideas how to do it. I mean, so specifically, you would want to compute trace h to the k1, trace h to the k2, and get the two energy distribution. I think that's doable. But one needs to work out the details. There's still a lot of details. And in any case, this will give you I mean, for sure, that will not give you the energy statistics at short distances, right? It would give you up to distances that scale like lambda. It won't give you the 1 over n, but maybe you can look at the large order behavior of that and resum or something like that.
So in the calculation of this crossing kernel, did you see structure of ladder diagrams Yinfei and Alexei was talking about?
No, I don't think you'll see it in the kernel. You'll see it in the details of the combinatorics. I mean, basically, this combinatorics that you need to do has to do with, you know, when you have this M block, codes can go in and come out, and you have to do some prescription in which you count stuff and you miss some diagrams and you correct, et cetera, et cetera. So that might be related to some ladder diagram, but it's not. No, I mean, you'll need to dig into that combinatorics.
You might need to take the classical limit because here it's right, it's a quantum limit. So, yeah, wondering if you take classical limit and do this quad diagram.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's an issue of looking. So we basically took the limit Q going to one of the final result. And there's an issue of can you do a more fine-grained analysis of like grouping the entire combinatorics machinery into different parts that scale differently with Q and then reconstruct the ladder diagrams in some sort. We haven't done that yet.
Thank you.
So G sigma formalism, we have this Schwarzian plus a lot of massive mode, high energy mode. So in your double scaling limit, this high energy mode is projected out, or can you see the signature of this high energy mode?
Okay, so operator. Okay, so we compute the entire spectrum.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the entire spectrum. We didn't miss out anything.
Can you extract out this high energy operator contains?
This is the full model. There's no other energy band that you need to worry about. Now, what this basically says, you know, suppose I want to throw in a particle. Okay, so the entire Hilbert space of the theory, which gets closer to the Hilbert space of the full quantum mechanics, is basically codes of H plus an arbitrary codes of these operators that I want to add, these probe operators. So this is explicitly saying what are the allowed particles. Now, the reason that you see the entire spectrum just in the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is just a statement about gravity, that whatever particle you throw in, if you're interested in its energy, you might as well just look at the graviton behavior at near the boundary. So the energy sums over all of this stuff, but if you want to compute, and this is the entire spectrum, but if you want to reconstruct the entire Hilbert space, it's made out of codes of H's plus codes of these M particles, and that's explicitly building a Fock space on ADS2. I mean, that's at least the current take on it.
Let me follow up on that question. So if you take the two operators, two identical operators, and you cut the middle line.
Consider the four-point function, and you try to expand in intermediate states. Do you get just the vacuum states in the middle, or?
No. You get.
Could we go back to the pictures of four-point function? I'm thinking of the time.
Yeah, I mean, so let's do the two-point function. So if I cut it somewhere in the middle, I have a bunch of H's and
I think of M's. Can we look at the four-point function? Yeah. My question is about the four-point function.
We don't. I mean, this is just the two-point functions in general.
But you had a diagram. If you go back a couple of slides. There.
Yes.
There. So there in the diagram on the left, and you cut in the middle, right? So that would be like doing the operator product expansion. So if you do it in the conformal limit for low Q and so on, you see a bunch of operators. I think those were the massive modes that he was asking about. Now, in this case, if you were to cut there and try to look at what states in the Hilbert space you have there. It looks like you have the vacuum. Well, naively.
No, well, and not exactly. I mean the diagram that corresponds to this is I have say this is one of insertion. This is say some other insertion. Let's call it. Let's make it wiggly, and then there are all kinds of H's. Now, if I cut it here, I just see the two particle state. Okay. Now, if I want to identify bound states of this, I need to do this procedure of, you know, analyzing poles here, maybe, or something like this. But this, if you wish, is the Hilbert space with the matter field. So.
Do you have a formula for those bound state energies?
No. It's you know, it's hiding somewhere in the four-point function, but we didn't do this processing yet. But I kind of just build. I mean, if you wish, it's just I build the Fock space by hand. I mean, in this machinery.
So you're sort of.
I mean that said. I mean, it's still true that you just propagate. Using this matrix, and these are kind of static backgrounds. So, I mean, if you wish, it gives me the boundary theory too good, because it gives me the full energy on the boundary, not the gravitational energy and particle energy.
Yeah, so summing over these court arrangements is sort of reminiscent of various ideas from integral geometry, so I was wondering whether you could recycle some of those techniques relating that to volumes, or especially in light of your sort of last comment construction.
Well, I don't know how to think of, I mean, it would really be nice to have a model like this in higher dimensions, which we don't have yet, so I mean, maybe. I mean, I think then you can explore what you're saying. But if there was a higher dimensional version, then I would say this bit thread, these, you know, threads that you're working on to get the entanglement entropy would be some nice way, maybe related to this. Yeah, no, I'm taking it. No, I don't know how to, I don't know the direct relation. Yeah.
Last question. A technical question. The topology of these diagrams you have there looks similar to those in one-dimensional electron gases where you have disorder and can't apply a non-crossing approximation. I mean, you get all these crossings and you have mm-hmm. to. Now, in the early 70s, people invented efficient resummation techniques in terms of transfer matrices.
Okay.
To obtain non-perturbative solutions. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if you know this stuff, or perhaps.
No, I would really love to
okay,
see that.
Put these yeah.
No, I don't know that.
Okay, so let's thank Mikhail again.
Thank you.
So we reconvene here at 11:30. Thank you.